Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, you get two stories, both written by Pulitzer Prize winners William Faulkner and Booth Tarkington. Faulkner won the Pulitzer Prize twice and the Nobel Prize once too. Most of his writings are Southern Gothic, focusing on sexuality and race. Tarkington also won the Pulitzer Prize twice, but no Nobel Prize. Still, he was considered the best American author in the 1910s and 20s, though he is little known today. The stories you'll hear are A Rose for Emily by Faulkner and Ariel's Triumph by Tarkington. And now, A Rose for Emily by William Faulkner. When Miss Emily Grierson died, our whole town went to her funeral. The men, through a sort of respectful affection for a fallen monument, the women mostly out of curiosity to see the inside of her house, which no one save an old manservant, a combined gardener and cook, had seen in at least 10 years. It was a big, squarish frame house that had once been white, decorated with cupolas and spires and scrolled balconies, in the heavily lightsome style of the 70s, set on what had once been our most select street. But garages and cotton gins had encroached and obliterated even the august names of that neighborhood. Only Miss Emily's house was left, lifting its stubborn and coquettish decay above the cotton wagons and the gasoline pumps, an eyesore among eyesores. And now Miss Emily had gone to join the representatives of those august names, where they lay in the cedar-bemused cemetery, among the ranked and anonymous graves of Union and Confederate soldiers who fell at the Battle of Jefferson. Alive, Miss Emily had been a tradition, a duty, and a care, a sort of hereditary obligation upon the town, dating from that day in 1894, when Colonel Sartoris, the mayor, who had fathered the edict that no Negro woman should appear on the streets without an apron, remitted her taxes, the dispensation dating from the death of her father on into perpetuity. Not that Miss Emily would have accepted charity. Colonel Sartoris invented an involved tale to the effect that Miss Emily's father had loaned money to the town, which the town, as a matter of business, preferred this way of repaying. Only a man of Colonel Sartoris's generation and thought could have invented it, and only a woman could have believed it. When the next generation, with its more modern ideas, became mayors and aldermen, this arrangement created some little dissatisfaction. On the first of the year, they mailed her a tax notice. February came, and there was no reply. They wrote her a formal letter asking her to call at the sheriff's office at her convenience. A week later, the mayor wrote her himself, offering to call or to send his car for her, and received in reply a note on paper of an archaic shape, in a thin, flowing calligraphy in faded ink, to the effect that she no longer went out at all. The tax notice was also enclosed, without comment. They called a special meeting of the Board of Aldermen. A deputation waited upon her, knocked at her door, through which no visitor had passed since she ceased giving china painting lessons 8 or 10 years earlier. They were admitted by the old Negro in a dim hall from which a stairway mounted into still more shadow. It smelled of dust and disuse, a close, dank smell. The Negro led them into the parlor. It was furnished in heavy, leather-covered furniture. When the Negro opened the blinds of one window, they could see the leather was cracked, and when they sat down, a faint dust rose sluggishly about their thighs, spinning with slow motes in a single sunray. On a tarnished gilt easel before the fireplace stood a crayon portrait of Miss Emily's father. They rose when she entered, a small, fat woman in black, with a thin gold chain descending to her waist and vanishing into her belt, leaning on an ebony cane with a tarnished gold head. Her skeleton was small and spare. Perhaps that was why what would have been merely plumpness in another was obesity in her. She looked bloated, like a body long submerged in motionless water, and of that pallid hue. Her eyes, lost in the fatty ridges of her face, looked like two small pieces of coal pressed into a lump of dough as they moved from one face to another while the visitors stated their errand. She did not ask them to sit. She just stood in the door and listened quietly until the spokesman came to a stumbling halt. Then they could hear the invisible watch ticking at the end of the gold chain. Her voice was dry and cold.
"I have no taxes in Jefferson. Colonel Sartoris explained it to me. Perhaps one of you can gain access to the city records and satisfy yourselves."
"But we have. We are the city's authorities, Miss Emily. Didn't you get a notice from the sheriff, signed by him?"
"I received a paper, yes," Miss Emily said. "Perhaps he considers himself the sheriff. I have no taxes in Jefferson."
"But there is nothing on the books to show that. You see, we must go by the..."
"See, Colonel Sartoris, I have no taxes in Jefferson."
"But, Miss Emily..."
"See, Colonel Sartoris."
Colonel Sartoris had been dead almost 10 years.
"I have no taxes in Jefferson. Toby!"
The Negro appeared.
"Show these gentlemen out."
So she vanquished them, horse and foot, just as she had vanquished their fathers 30 years before about the smell. That was 2 years after her father's death, and a short time after her sweetheart, the one we believe would marry her, had deserted her. After her father's death, she went out very little. After her sweetheart went away, people hardly saw her at all. A few of the ladies had the temerity to call, but were not received, and the only sign of life about the place was the Negro man, a young man then, going in and out with a market basket.
"Just as if a man, any man, could keep a kitchen properly," the ladies said, so they were not surprised when the smell developed.
It was another link between the gross, teeming world and the high and mighty Griersons. A neighbor, a woman, complained to the mayor, Judge Stevens, 80 years old.
"But what will you have me do about it, madam?" he said.
"Why, send her word to stop," the woman said. "Isn't there a law?"
"I'm sure that won't be necessary," Judge Stevens said. "It was probably just a snake or a rat that Negro of hers killed in the yard. I'll speak to him about it."
The next day, he received 2 more complaints, one from a man who came in diffident deprecation.
"We really must do something about it, Judge. I'll be the last one in the world to bother Miss Emily, but we've got to do something."
That night, the Board of Aldermen met. 3 graybeards and 1 younger man, a member of the rising generation.
"It's simple enough," he said. "Send her word to have her place cleaned up. Give her a certain time to do it in, and if she don't..."
"Damn it, sir," Judge Stevens said. "Will you accuse a lady to her face of smelling bad?"
So the next night, after midnight, 4 men crossed Miss Emily's lawn and slunk about the house like burglars, sniffing along the base of the brickwork and at the cellar openings while one of them performed a regular sewing motion with his hand out of a sack slung from his shoulder. They broke open the cellar door and sprinkled lime there and in all the outbuildings. As they recrossed the lawn, a window that had been dark was lighted, and Miss Emily sat in it, the light behind her, and her upright torso motionless as that of an idol. They crept quietly along the lawn and into the shadow of the locusts that lined the street. After a week or two, the smell went away. That was when people had begun to really feel sorry for her. People in our town, remembering how old Lady Watt, her great-aunt, had gone completely crazy at last, believed that the Griersons held themselves a little too high for what they really were. None of the young men were quite good enough for Miss Emily and such. We had long thought of them as a tableau, Miss Emily a slender figure in white in the background, her father a spraddling silhouette in the foreground, his back to her and clutching a horsewhip, the two of them framed by the back-flung front door. And when she got to be 30 and was still single, we were not pleased exactly, but vindicated. Even with insanity in the family, she wouldn't have turned down all of her chances if they had really materialized.
When her father died, it got about that the house was all that was left to her, and in a way, people were glad. At least they could pity Miss Emily. Being left alone and a pauper, she had become humanized. Now she, too, would know the old thrill and the old despair of a penny, more or less. The day after his death, all the ladies prepared to call at the house and offer condolences and aid, as is our custom. Miss Emily met them at the door, dressed as usual and with no trace of grief on her face. She told them that her father was not dead. She did that for 3 days, with the ministers calling on her and the doctors trying to persuade her to let them dispose of the body. Just as they were about to resort to law and force, she broke down, and they buried her father quickly. We did not say she was crazy then. We believed she had to do that. We remembered all the young men her father had driven away, and we knew that with nothing left, she would have to cling to that which had robbed her, as people will. She was sick for a long time. When we saw her again, her hair was cut short, making her look like a girl with a vague resemblance to those angels in colored church windows. Sort of tragic and serene. The town had just let the contracts for paving the sidewalks, and in the summer after her father's death, they began the work. The construction company came with Negroes in mills and machinery and a foreman named Homer Barron, a Yankee. A big, dark, ready man with a big voice and his eyes lighter than his face. The little boys would follow in groups to hear him cuss at the Negroes, and the Negroes singing in time to the rise and fall of picks. Pretty soon he knew everybody in town. Whenever you heard a lot of laughing anywhere about the square, Homer Barron would be in the center of the group. Presently we began to see him and Emily on Sunday afternoons, driving in the yellow-wheeled buggy and the matched team of bays from the livery stable. At first we were glad that Miss Emily would have an interest, because the ladies all said, of course a Grierson would not think seriously of a northerner, a day laborer. But there were still others, older people, who said that even grief could not cause a real lady to forget noblesse oblige without calling it noblesse oblige. They just said, poor Emily, her kinsfolk should come to her. She had some kin in Alabama, but years ago her father had fallen out with them over the estate of old Lady Wyatt, the crazy woman, and there was no communication between the two families. They had not even been represented at the funeral. And as soon as the old people said, poor Emily, the whispering began. Do you suppose it's really so? They said to one another. Of course it is. What else could? This behind their hands, rustling of craned silk and satin, behind jalousies closed upon the sun of Sunday afternoon, as the thin, swift clop, clop, clop of the matched team passed. Poor Emily. She carried her head high enough. Even when we believed that she was fallen, it was as if she had demanded more than ever the recognition of her dignity as the last Grierson, as if it had wanted that touch of earthiness to reaffirm her imperviousness. Like when she bought that rat poison, the arsenic. That was over a year after they had begun to say, poor Emily, and while the two female cousins were visiting her. I want some poison, she said to the druggist. She was over 30 then, still a slight woman, though thinner than usual, with cold, hearty black eyes and a face the flesh of which was strained across the temples, and the eye sockets, as you imagine, a lighthouse keeper's face ought to look. I want some poison, she said.
Yes, Miss Emily, what kind? For rats and such, I recommend...
I want the best you have. I don't care what kind. The druggist named several.
They'll kill anything up to an elephant, but what you want is arsenic, Miss Emily said.
Is that a good one?
Is arsenic, yes, ma'am, but what you want...
I want arsenic. The druggist looked down at her. She looked back at him, erect, her face like a strained flag.
Why, of course, said the druggist, if that's what you want. But the law requires you to tell what you're going to use it for.
Miss Emily just stared at him, her head tilted back in order to look him eye for eye, until he looked away and went and got the arsenic and wrapped it up. The Negro delivery boy brought her the package. The druggist didn't come back. When she opened the package at home, there was written on the box, under the skull and crossbones, "For rats." So the next day, we all said, "She will kill herself." And we said it would be the best thing. When she had first begun to be seen with Homer Barron, we had said she will marry him. Then we said, "She will persuade him yet." Because Homer himself had remarked he liked men, and it was known that he drank with the younger men in the Elks Club, that he was not a marrying man. Later we said, "Poor Emily," behind the jalousies as they passed on Sunday afternoon in the glittering buggy, Miss Emily with her head high and Homer Barron with his hat cocked and a cigar in his teeth, reins and whip in a yellow glove. Then some of the ladies began to say that it was a disgrace to the town and a bad example to young people. The men did not want to interfere, but at last the ladies forced the Baptist minister, Miss Emily's people were Episcopal, to call upon her. He would never divulge what happened during that interview, but he refused to go back again. The next Sunday they again drove about the streets, and the following day the minister's wife wrote to Miss Emily's relations in Alabama. So she had Bloodkin under her roof again, and we sat back to watch developments. At first nothing happened. Then we were sure that they were to be married. We learned that Miss Emily had been to the jeweler's and ordered a man's toilet set in silver, with the letters HB on each piece. 2 days later we learned that she had bought a complete outfit of men's clothing, including a nightshirt. And we said, "They are married." We were really glad. We were glad because the two female cousins were even more Grierson than Miss Emily had ever been. So we were not surprised when Homer Barron, the streets had been finished some time since, was gone. We were a little disappointed that there was not a public blowing off, but we believed that he had gone on to prepare for Miss Emily's coming, or to give her a chance to get rid of the cousins. By that time, it was a cabal, and we were all Miss Emily's allies to help circumvent the cousins. Sure enough, after another week they departed, and as we had expected all along, within 3 days Homer Barron was back in town. A neighbor saw the Negro man admit him at the kitchen door at dusk one evening. And that was the last we saw of Homer Barron, and of Miss Emily for some time. The Negro man went in and out with the market basket, but the front door remained closed. Now and then we would see her at a window for a moment, as the men did that night when they sprinkled the lime, but for almost 6 months she did not appear on the streets. Then we knew that this was to be expected, too, as if that quality of her father which had thwarted her woman's life so many times had been too virulent and too furious to die. When we next saw Miss Emily, she had grown fat and her hair was turning gray. During the next few years it grew grayer and grayer, until it attained an even salt-and-pepper iron gray, when it ceased turning. Up to the day of her death at 74, it was still that vigorous iron gray, like the hair of an active man. From that time on, her front door remained closed, save for a period of 6 or 7 years when she was about 40, during which she gave lessons in china painting. She fitted up a studio in one of the downstairs rooms where the daughters and granddaughters of Colonel Sartorius's contemporaries were sent to her with the same regularity and in the same spirit that they were sent to church on Sundays with a 25-cent piece for the collection plate. Meanwhile, her taxes had been remitted. Then the new generation became the backbone and the spirit of the town, and the painting pupils grew up and fell away and did not send their children to her with boxes of color and tedious brushes and pictures cut from ladies' magazines. The front door closed upon the last one and remained closed for good. When the town got free postal delivery, Miss Emily alone refused to let them fasten the metal numbers above her door and attach a mailbox to it. She would not listen to them. Daily, monthly, yearly, we watched the Negro grow grayer and more stooped, going in and out with the market basket. Each December we sent her a tax notice, which would be returned by the post office a week later, unclaimed. Now and then we would see her in one of the downstairs windows. She had evidently shut up the top floor of the house. like the carven torso of an idol in a niche, looking or not looking at us, we could never tell which. Thus she passed from generation to generation, dear, inescapable, impervious, tranquil, and perverse. And so she died, fell ill in the house, filled with dust and shadows, with only a doddering Negro man to wait on her. We did not even know she was sick. We had long since given up trying to get any information from the Negro. He talked to no one, probably not even to her, for his voice had grown harsh and rusty, as if from disuse. She died in one of the downstairs rooms, in a heavy walnut bed with a curtain, her gray head propped on a pillow, yellow and moldy with age and lack of sunlight. The Negro met the first of the ladies at the front door and let them in, with their hushed, sibilant voices and their quick, curious glances, and then he disappeared, walked right through the house and out the back, and was not seen again. The two female cousins came at once. They held the funeral on the second day, with the town coming to look at Miss Emily, beneath a mass of bought flowers, with the crayon face of her father musing profoundly above the bier, and the ladies sibilant and macabre. And the very old men, some in their brushed Confederate uniforms, on the porch and the lawn, talking of Miss Emily as if she had been a contemporary of theirs, believing that they had danced with her and courted her, perhaps, confusing time with its mathematical progression, as the old do, to whom all the past is not a diminished road, but instead a huge meadow which no winter ever quite touches, divided from them now by the narrow bottleneck of the most recent decade of years. Already we knew that there was one room in that region above the stairs which no one had seen in 40 years, and which would have to be forced. They waited until Miss Emily was decently in the ground before they opened it. The violence of breaking down the door seemed to fill this room with pervaded dust. A thin, acrid pall, as of the tomb, seemed to lie everywhere upon this room, decked and furnished as for a bridal. Upon the valance curtains of faded rose color, upon the rose-shaded lights, upon the dressing table, upon the delicate array of crystal and the men's toilet things backed with tarnished silver, silver so tarnished that the monogram was obscured. Among them lay a collar and a tie, as if they had just been removed, which, lifted, left upon the surface a pale crescent in the dust. Upon a chair hung the suit, carefully folded, beneath it two mute shoes and the discarded socks. The man himself lay in the bed. For a long while we just stood there, looking down at the profound and fleshless grin. The body had apparently once lain in the attitude of an embrace, but now the long sleep that outlasts love, that conquers even the grimace of love, had cockled at him. What was left of him, rotted beneath what was left of the nightshirt, had become inextricable from the bed in which he lay, and upon him and upon the pillow beside him lay that even coating of the patient and biding dust. Then we noticed that in the second pillow was the indentation of a head. One of us lifted something from it, and leaning forward, that faint and invisible dust, dry and acrid in the nostrils, we saw a long strand of iron gray hair. Ariel's Triumph by Booth Tarkington. Ariel had worked all afternoon over her mother's wedding gown, and 2 hours were required by her toilet for the dance. She curled her hair frizzily, burning it here and there with a slate pencil heated over a lamp chimney, and she placed above one ear 3 or 4 large artificial roses, taken from an old hat of her mother's, which she had found in a trunk in the storeroom. Possessing no slippers, she carefully blackened and polished her shoes, which had been clumsily resoled, and fastened into the strings of each small rosettes of red ribbon, after which she practiced swinging the train of her skirt until she was proud of her manipulation of it. She had no powder, but found in her grandfather's room a lump of magnesia, which he was in the habit of taking for heartburn, and passed it over and over her brown face and hands. Then a lingering gaze into her small mirror gave her joy at last. She yearned so hard to see herself charming that she did see herself so. Admiration came, and she told herself that she was more attractive to look at than she had ever been in her life, and that perhaps at last she might begin to be sought for like the other girls. The little glass showed a sort of prettiness in her thin, unmatured young face. Tripping dance tunes ran through her head, her feet keeping the time. Ah, oh, she did so hope to dance often that night. Perhaps she might be asked for every number. And so, wrapping an old waterproof cloak around her, she took her grandfather's arm and sallied forth with high hopes in her beating heart. It was in the dressing room that the change began to come. Alone at home in her own ugly little room, she had thought herself almost beautiful. But here, in the bright-lighted chamber crowded with the other girls, it was different. There was a big cheval glass at one end of the room, and she faced it when her turn came, for the mirror was popular, with a sinking spirit. There was the contrast, like a picture painted and framed. The other girls all wore their hair after the fashion introduced to Canaan by Mamie Pike the week before, on her return from a visit to Chicago. None of them had crimped, and none had bedecked their tresses with artificial flowers. Her alterations of the wedding dress had not been successful. The skirt was too short in front and higher on one side than the other, showing too plainly the heavy-soled shoes, which had lost most of their polish in the walk through the snow. The ribbon rosettes were fully revealed, and as she glanced at their reflection, she heard the words, "Look at that train and those rosettes," whispered behind her, and saw in the mirror two pretty young women turn away with their handkerchiefs over their mouth and retreat hurriedly to an alcove. All the feet in the room except Ariel's were in dainty kid or satin slippers of the color of the dresses from which they glimmered out, and only Ariel wore a train. She went away from the mirror and pretended to be busy with a hanging thread in her sleeve. She was singularly an alien in the chattering room, although she had been born and had lived all her life in the town. Perhaps her position among the young ladies may be best defined by the remark, generally current among them that evening, to the effect that it was very sweet of Mamie to invite her. Ariel was not like the others. She was not of them, and never had been. Indeed, she did not know them very well. Some of them nodded to her and gave her a word of greeting pleasantly. All of them whispered about her, with wonder and suppressed amusement, but none talked to her. They were not unkind, but they were young and eager and excited over their own interests, which were then in the gentleman's dressing room. Each of the girls had been escorted by a youth of the place, and one by one, joining these escorts in the hall outside the door, they descended the stairs, until only Ariel was left. She came down alone after the first dance had begun, and greeted her young hostess's mother timidly. Mrs. Pike, a small, frightened-looking woman with a ruby necklace, answered her absently, and hurried away to see that the imported waiters did not steal anything. Ariel sat in one of the chairs against the wall and watched the dancers with a smile of eager and benevolent interest. In Canaan, no parents, no guardians or aunts were haled forth the nights to duenna the junketings of youth. Mrs. Pike did not reappear, and Ariel sat conspicuously alone. There was nothing else for her to do, but it was not an easy matter. When the first dance reached an end, Mamie Pike came to her for a moment with a cheery welcome, and was immediately surrounded by a circle of young men and women, flushed with dancing, shouting as was their wont, laughing inexplicably over words and phrases and unintelligible monosyllables, as if they all belonged to a secret society, and these cries were symbols of things exquisitely humorous, which only they understood. Ariel laughed with them more heartily than any other, so that she might seem to be of them, and as merry as they were, but almost immediately she found herself outside of the circle, and presently they all whirled away into another dance, and she was left alone again.
So she sat, no one coming near her, through the several dances, trying to maintain the smile of delighted interest upon her face, though she felt the muscles of her face beginning to ache with their fixedness, her eyes growing hot and glazed. All the other girls were provided with partners for every dance, with several young men left over, these latter lounging hilariously together in the doorways. Ariel was careful not to glance toward them, but she could not help hating them. Once or twice between the dances, she saw Miss Pike speaking appealingly to one of the superfluous, glancing at the same time in her own direction, and Ariel could see, too, that the appeal proved unsuccessful, until at last Mamie approached her, leading Norbert Filtcroft, partly by the hand, partly by willpower. Norbert was an excessively fat boy, and at the present moment looked as patient as the blind, and he asked Ariel if she was engaged for the next dance, and Mamie, having flitted away, stood disconsolately beside her, waiting for the music to begin. Ariel was grateful for him. "I think you must be very good-natured, Mr. Filtcroft," she said with an air of raillery.
"No, I'm not," he replied plaintively. "Everybody thinks I am because I'm fat, and they expect me to do things they never dream of asking anybody else to do. I'd like to see him even ask Jean Bantry to go and do some of the things they get me to do. A person isn't good-natured just because he's fat," he concluded morbidly. "But he might as well be."
"Oh, well, I meant good-natured," she returned with a sprightly laugh, "because you're willing to waltz with me."
"Oh, well," he returned, sighing. "That's all right."
The orchestra flourished into La Paloma. He put his arm mournfully about her, and taking her right hand with his left, carried her arm out to a rigid right angle, beginning to pump and balance for time. They made three false starts and then got away. Ariel danced badly. She hopped and lost the step, but they persevered, bumping against other couples continuously. Circling breathlessly into the next room, they passed close to a long mirror in which Ariel saw herself, although in a flash, more bitterly contrasted to the others than in the cheval glass of the dressing room. The clump of roses was flopping about her neck, her crimped hair looked frowsy, and there was something terribly wrong about her dress. Suddenly, she felt her train to be grotesque, as a thing following her in a nightmare. A moment later, she caught her partner making a burlesque face of suffering over her shoulder, and turning her head quickly, saw for whose benefit he was constructing it. Eugene Bantry, flying expertly by with Mamie, was bestowing upon Mr. Filtcroft a commiserative wink. The next instant, she tripped in her train and fell to the floor at Eugene's feet, carrying her partner with her. There was a shout of laughter. The young hostess stopped Eugene, who would have gone on, and he had no choice but to stoop to Ariel's assistance.
"It seems to be a habit of mine," she said, laughing loudly.
She did not appear to see the hand he offered, but got on her feet without help and walked quickly away with Norbert, who proceeded to live up to the character he had given himself.
"Perhaps we'd better not try again," she laughed.
"Well, I should think not,"
he returned, with the frankest gloom. With the air of conducting her home, he took her to the chair against the wall whence he had brought her. There his responsibility for her seemed to cease.
"Will you excuse me?"
he asked, and there was no doubt he felt that he had been given more than his share that evening, even though he was fat.
"Yes, indeed," her laughter was continuous. "I should think you would be glad to get rid of me after that. Poor Mr. Filtcroft, you know you are."
It was the deadly truth, and the fat one, saying,
"Well, if you'll excuse me now,"
hurried away with a step which grew lighter as the distance from her increased. Arrived at the haven of a far door, he mopped his brow and shook his head grimly in response to frequent rallyings. Ariel sat through more dances, interminable dances and intermissions, in that same chair in which it began to seem she was to live out the rest of her life. Now and then she thought people were looking at her as they passed. She broke into a laugh and nodded slightly, as if still amused over her mishap. After a long time she rose, and laughing cheerfully to Mr. Flitcroft, who was standing in the doorway and replied with a wan smile, stepped out quickly into the hall, where she almost ran into her great-uncle Jonas Tabor. He was going toward the big front doors with Judge Pike, having just come out of the latter's library down the hall.
Jonas was breathing heavily and was shockingly pale, though his eyes were very bright. He turned his back upon his grandniece sharply and went out of the door. Ariel re-entered the room whence she had come. She laughed again to her fat friend as she passed him, went to the window and looked out. The porch seemed deserted and was faintly illuminated by a few Japanese lanterns. She sprang out, dropped upon the divan, and burying her face in her hands, cried heartbrokenly. Presently she felt something alive touch her foot, and her breath catching with alarm, she started to rise. A thin hand issuing from a stubby sleeve had stolen out between two of the green tubs and was pressing upon one of her shoes. "Shh," warned a voice. "Don't make a noise." The warning was not needed. She had recognized the hand and sleeve instantly. It was her playmate and lifelong friend, Joe Loudon.
"What were you going on about?" he asked angrily.
"Nothing," she answered. "I wasn't. You must go away. You know the judge doesn't like you."
"What were you crying about?" interrupted the uninvited guest.
"Nothing, I tell you," she repeated, the tears not ceasing to gather in her eyes. "I wasn't."
"I want to know what it was," he insisted. "Didn't the fools ask you to dance?" "Ah, you needn't tell me. That's it. I've been here watching for the last three dances, and you weren't in sight till you came to the window." "Well, what do you care about that for?"
"I don't," she answered. "I don't." Then suddenly, without being able to prevent it, she sobbed.
"No," he said gently. "I see you don't. And you let yourself be a fool because there are a lot of fools in there."
She gave way all at once to a gust of sorrow and bitterness. She bent far over and caught his hand and laid it against her wet cheek. "Oh, Joe," she whispered brokenly, "I think we have such hard lives, you and I. It doesn't seem right. While we're so young, why can't we be like the others? Why can't we have some fun?" He withdrew his hand with the embarrassment and shame he would have felt had she been a boy.
"Oh, get out," he said feebly.
She did not seem to notice, but still stooping, rested her elbows on her knees and her face in her hands. "I try so hard to have some fun, to be like the rest, and it's always a mistake, always, always, always." She rocked herself slightly from side to side. "I'm a fool, it's the truth, or I wouldn't have come tonight. I want to be attractive. I want to be in things. I want to laugh as they do."
"To laugh? Just to laugh, and not because there's something funny?"
"Yes, I do, I do. And to know how to dress and to wear my hair. There must be some place where you can learn those things. I've never had anyone to show me. It's only lately I've cared, but I'm 17, Joe." She faltered, came to a stop, and her whole body was shaken with sobs. "I hate myself so for crying, for everything." Just then a waiter, smiling graciously, came out upon the porch, bearing a tray of salad, hot oysters, and coffee. At his approach, Joe had fallen prone on the floor in the shadow. Ariel shook her head to the proffer of refreshments.
"I don't want any," she murmured.
The waiter turned away in pity and was re-entering the window when a passionate whisper fell upon his ear as well as upon Ariel's.
"Take it."
"Ma'am,"
said the waiter. "I've changed my mind," she said quickly. The waiter, his elation restored, gave of his viands. When he had gone,
"Give me everything that's hot," said Joe. "You can keep the salad."
"I couldn't eat it, or anything else,"
she answered, thrusting the plate between the palms. For a time there was silence. From within the house came the continuous babble of voices and laughter, the clink of cutlery on china. The young people spent a long time over their supper, and by the waiter returned to the veranda, depositing a plate of colored ices upon Ariel's knees with a noble gesture, and departed.
"No ice for me," said Joe.
"Won't you please go now?" she entreated.
"Wouldn't be good manners," he joked. "They might think I only came for the supper."
"Give me the dish and coffee cup," she whispered impatiently. "Suppose the waiter came and had to look for them. Quick!" A bottle-shaped figure appeared in the window, and she had no time to take the plate and cup, which were being pushed through the palm leaves. She whispered a word of warning, and the dishes were hurriedly withdrawn as Norbert Filtcroft, wearing a solemn expression of injury, came out upon the veranda.
"They want you. Someone's come for you."
"Oh, is Grandfather waiting?" She rose.
"It isn't your grandfather that has come for you," answered the fat one slowly. "It is, Askew Arp. Something's happened."
She looked at him for a moment, beginning to tremble violently, her eyes growing wide with fright. "Is my grandfather? Is he sick?"
"You better go and see. Old Askew's waiting in the hall. He'll tell you."
She was by him and through the window instantly. Mr. Arp was waiting in the hall, talking in a low voice to Mrs. Pike.
"Your grandfather's all right,"
he told the frightened girl quickly.
"He sent me for you. Just hurry and get your things."
She was with him again in a moment, and, seizing the old man's arm, hurried him down the steps and toward the street almost at a run. "You're not telling me the truth," she said. "You're not telling me the truth."
"Nothing has happened to Roger Tabor," panted Mr. Arp. "We're going this way, not that."
They had come to the gate, and as she turned to the right, he pulled her sharply to the left.
"Where are we going?"
she demanded.
"To your Uncle Jonas's."
"Why?" she cried in supreme astonishment. "What do you want to take me there for? Don't you know that he doesn't like me? That he's stopped speaking to me?"
"Yes," said the old man grimly. "He has stopped speaking to everybody."
These startled words told Ariel that her uncle was dead. They did not tell her what she was soon to learn, that he had died rich, and that failing other heirs, she and her grandfather had inherited his fortune. It was Sunday in Canaan, Sunday some years later. Joe Loudon was sitting in the shade of Main Street Bridge, smoking a cigar. He was alone. He was always alone, for he had been away a long time and had made few friends since his return. A breeze wandered up the river and touched the leaves and grass to life. The young corn, deep green in the bottomland, moved with a staccato flurry. The stirring air brought a smell of blossoms. The distance took on faint lavender hazes which blended the outlines of the fields. Lying like square coverlets on the long slope of rising ground beyond the bottomland, and empurpled the blue woodland shadows of the groves. For the first time, it struck Joe that it was a beautiful day. He opened his eyes and looked about him whimsically. Then he shook his head again. A lady had just emerged from the bridge and was coming toward him. It would be hard to get at Joe's first impressions of her. We can find conveyance only for the broadest and heaviest. At first sight of her, there was preeminently the shock of seeing anything so exquisite in his accustomed world. For she was exquisite. She was that and much more. From the ivory ferrule of the parasol she carried to the light and slender footprint she left in the dust of the road, Joe knew at once that nothing like her had ever before been seen in Canaan. He had little knowledge of the millinery arts, and he needed none to see the harmony of the things she wore. Her dress and hat and gloves and parasol showed a pale lavender overtint like that which he had seen overspreading the western slope. Under the summer hat, her very dark hair swept back over the temples with something near trimness in the extent to which it was withheld from being fluffy. It may be that this approach to trimness, after all, was the true key to the mystery of the lady who appeared to Joe. She was to pass him, so he thought, and as she drew nearer, his breath came faster, and then he realized that something wonderful was happening to him. She had stopped directly in front of him, stopped and stood looking at him with clear eyes. He did not lift his own to her. A great and unaccountable shyness beset him. He had risen and removed his hat, trying not to clear his throat, his everyday sense urging upon him that she was a stranger in Canaan who had lost her way.
Can I?
He stammered, blushing, meaning to finish with direct you or show you the way. Then he looked at her again and saw what seemed to him the strangest sight of life. The lady's eyes had filled with tears, filled and overfilled.
"I'll sit here on the log with you," she said.
"You don't need to dust it," she went on tremulously. And even then he did not know who she was. There was a silence, for if the dazzled young man could have spoke at all, he could have found nothing to say, and perhaps the lady would not trust her own voice just then. His eyes had fallen again. He was too dazed, and in truth too panic-stricken now to look at her. She was seated beside him and had handed him her parasol in a little way which seemed to imply that, of course, he had reached for it, so that it was to be seen how used she was to have all such things done for her. He saw that he was expected to furl the dainty thing. He pressed the catch and let down the top timidly, as if fearing to break it or tear it, and as it closed, held near his face, he caught a very faint, sweet, spicy emanation from it, like wild roses and cinnamon. "Do you know me?" asked the lady at last. For answer, he could only stare at her, dumbfounded. He lifted an unsteady hand toward her appealingly. Her manner underwent an April change. She drew back lightly. He was favored with the most delicious, low laugh he had ever heard. "I'm glad you're the same, Joe," she said. "I'm glad you're the same, and I'm glad I've changed, though this isn't why you've forgotten me." He arose, uncertainly, and took 3 or 4 steps backwards from her. She sat before him, radiant with laughter, the loveliest creature he had ever seen. But between him and this charming vision, there swept through the warm, scented June air the dim picture of a veranda, all in darkness, and the faint music of violins.
Ariel Tabor.
"Isn't it about time you were recognizing me?" she said. Sensations were rare in staid, dull, commonplace Canaan, but this fine Sunday morning the town was treated to one of the most memorable sensations in its history. The town, all except Joe Loudon, had known for weeks that Ariel Tabor was coming home from abroad, but it had not seen her. And when she walked along the street with Joe, past the Sunday church-returning crowds, it is not quite truth to say that all except the children came to a dead halt, but it is not very far from it. The air was thick with subdued exclamations and whisperings. Joe had not known her. The women recognized her, infallibly at first sight, even those who had quite forgotten her. And the women told their men. Hence the un-Sunday-like demeanor of the procession, for few towns held it more unseemingly to stand and stare at passers-by, especially on the Sabbath. But Ariel Tabor had returned. A low but increasing murmur followed the two as they proceeded. It ran up the street ahead of them. People turned to look back and paused, so that Ariel and Joe had to walk around 1 or 2 groups. They had also to walk round Norbert Filtcroft, which was very like walking round a group. Mr. Filtcroft was one of the few—he was waddling home alone—who did not identify Miss Tabor, and her effect upon him was extraordinary. His mouth opened, and he gazed stodgily, his widening eyes like sundogs coming out of a fog. Mr. Filtcroft experienced a few moments of trance, came out of it stricken through and through, felt nervously of his tie, resolutely fell in behind and followed at a distance of some 40 paces, determined to learn what household this heavenly visitor honored, and thrilling with the intention to please that same household with his own presence as soon and as often as possible. Ariel flushed a little when she received the extent of their conspicuousness, but it was not the blush that Joe remembered had reddened the tanned skin of old. But her brownness had gone long ago, though it had not left her merely pink and white. There was a delicate rosiness rising from her cheeks to her temples, as the earliest dawn rises. Joe kept trying to realize that this lady of wonder was Ariel Tabor, but he could not. He could not connect the shabby Ariel, whom he had treated as one boy treats another, with this young woman of the world. Although he had only a dim perception of the staring and whispering which greeted and followed them, Ariel, of course, was thoroughly aware of it, though the only sign she gave was the slight blush, which very soon disappeared. Ariel paused before the impressive front of Judge Pike's large mansion. Joe's face expressed surprise. "Didn't you know?" she said.
I'm staying here. Judge Pike has charge of all my property. Come to see me this afternoon.
With a last charming smile, Ariel turned and left the dazed young man on the sidewalk. That walk was but the beginning of her triumph. Judge Pike's of a summer afternoon was the swirling social center of Canaan. But on that particular Sunday afternoon, every unattached male in the town who possessed the privilege of calling at the big house appeared. They filled the chairs in the wide old-fashioned hall where Ariel received them and overpoured on the broad steps of the old-fashioned spiral staircase, where Mr. Filtcroft, on account of his size, occupied two steps and a portion of a third. And Ariel was the center of it all. And that's our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed A Rose for Emily by William Faulkner and Ariel's Triumph by Booth Tarkington. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. Thank you.
Thank you.